You know what could destroy the entire financial system and all of your accumulated wealth? Derivatives. Yes, we're going to have to talk about derivatives today. Hello, everyone. I am Dr. Chris Martinson of Peak Prosperity. We are continuing with our series, our special series on what is called The Great Taking, which is a book by David Rogers Webb. And today we're taking a special deep dive into derivatives because we need to understand them. There's a lot of confusion around them. By the way, a lot of this material is material that I presented to my subscribers over this past year. If you like this kind of information ahead of time, early, and this level of context, you should join. It's an awesome thing what we have going on over at Peak Prosperity. So why did I call them weapons of mass financial destruction? Well, I didn't. Well, that would be Warren Buffett. He wrote, "Derivatives are financial weapons of mass destruction, carrying dangers that, while now latent, are potentially lethal." And so let's put this in context. Why are we talking about derivatives? How does this tie into the Great Taking? Remember, the Great Taking started with, you have these things called entitlement claims. Then we've said, well, if you have this, the subordinate claim, the junior claim, who has the senior claim? Excuse me. And so we figured that out, and that included all kinds of security contracts and derivatives. So we're going to talk about those more. We still have to talk about, well, what would actually happen? What would a bankruptcy look like? How would that materialize? We've got an incredible interview with a Dr. Suzanne Trimbath coming up that helps to explain some of that. That will be coming out a few days after this episode. So, and then finally, what happens when this magic term financial stability is invoked? And that's a whole nother concept. And we're going to have to dive into that a little bit more deeply at some point because it's a big deal. But we did part of that in episode 3 of this whole thing. Remember, we talked about this, that in the bank, sorry, in the Title 12 code, which refers to banking, in section 5390, we had here certain qualified financial contracts. It says here, rights of parties to contracts, rights of Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan and Citibank, you mean. And it says, hey, in that section I there, any right that such person has to cause, so no person shall be stayed or prohibited from exercising. Let me start up at the top there. JP Morgan cannot be prevented. Goldman Sachs cannot be prevented from any right that that entity has to cause the termination, liquidation, or acceleration of any qualified financial contract. So we talked about that last time a little bit. I just want to make sure we're all on the same page again here today. So wait a minute. There's these qualified financial contracts. They have a senior position in any sort of a workout structure or during times of stress. And it turns out that the people who hold, or the entities that hold these qualified financial contracts, have the senior position, and nobody can stop them from reaching in and taking what is theirs out of that mess when it's going down. And so what are qualified financial contracts? Well, we know here again from, this would be also from Title 12. So you can see in the link down there from law.cornell.edu, that 12 refers to Title 12. It says, certain contracts and agreements defined. Qualified financial contract means any, emphasis on any, securities contract, commodity contract, forward contract, repurchase agreement or repo, a swap agreement, any similar agreement that the FDIC, that's the corporation in this context, determines by regulation, resolution, or order to be a qualified financial contract for the purposes of this paragraph. So it's these things and anything else they sort of throw into the pile. If you're lucky and you're well-connected, and you have an ear that you can bend at the corporation during one of these magic moments where a big financial entity is going belly up, you could whisper in their ear and say, you know what, I think my portfolio is it. My personal portfolio? Yeah. Can we call that a qualified financial contract? Thanks. Right? That's how that would work, right? So that's the system. If it feels unfair, it's totally because it is. So let's talk about derivatives very quickly here. Types of them, futures. Futures contract, that's where you know, as a contract, it's an agreement to buy or sell an asset at a future date. You got futures on stock indexes, you have futures on cotton, you have futures on gold and silver, you have futures on oil, whatever. That's a futures contract. A forward are futures contracts that don't trade on an open exchange. These are little, that's why they show the handshake. This is like Party A and Party B do a forward contract, and each forward contract is a custom contract between the two parties. So it may well be that in this particular case, a financial entity has a forward contract or has guaranteed a set of forward contracts through a master agreement. And then, oops, trouble happens. And then they have to make good on that forward contract before they would give you your portfolio back, your stocks, your bonds. Options, we all know about options, I trust. So this is an option, which is the right but not the obligation to buy or sell a given thing, whether you're using a call or a put option. Swaps are typically used to hedge interest rates, all kinds of swaps out there. Now, how many derivatives are, those are all examples of derivatives. How many are there in the world? Well, we don't know. Ellen Brown writing about it as a quadrillion-dollar derivative tsunami. We have here Ergon von Greyer's writing that it's $2.3 quadrillion of things that are out there, but that's not just derivatives. That includes underfunded liabilities, I believe, other things like that. Now, in order to really be on top of this story, you would want to watch, well, we have three separate episodes that are up. You're watching right now. This is the public episode. There will be one for my subscribers. It's a companion piece to this, and that's what you're seeing here. First the public, then the companion piece, then public, then the companion piece for my membership subscribers, and then also public in the membership piece. So in every case, what I'm doing with these is I am first analyzing the great taking, looking at this in depth, helping you understand what it actually means. And then I talk about what you can do about it, because information without action could just be vexing or at best interesting. So that's what's going on back at peakprosperity.com. If you want to gain access to that, come and consider being a member if you like this level of context. Now, derivatives, what are they? Well, they're contracts. It's not a thing, right? If I said, hey, you know, I want to buy, a silver quarter from you. So this is a silver quarter. This one is from 1958, right? This is a thing, right? Ding. What is a derivative? It's a contract. That's all. It's a financial contract whose value is dependent on some underlying asset. So the derivatives are tied to an underlying asset. So it could be a derivative on stocks, a derivative on bonds, a derivative on commodities, a derivative on currencies, interest rates, market indices, all kinds of things. In fact, you could set a derivative on what the temperature is going to be a year from now on that given date. You know, here in Massachusetts, you might decide it's going to be 43 degrees. I might decide it's going to be higher than 43 degrees on that date, and we could set a derivative contract, but it would be a piece of paper that would define the terms. And this would fall under contract law. All right. So let's take a closer look, because it doesn't have to just, a derivative isn't just tied to an underlying asset. It also could be tied to an event. So in this case, we're looking at, say, a credit default swap. So this is a derivative product which serves as a form of insurance against the default of an underlying borrower or a debt instrument. So you and I might decide to trade a credit default swap. I think, you know what? In 3 years, I think this company that you and I are talking about, you know, this company X, I think it's going to go bankrupt. And you think, no way, not going to happen. So we could do a credit default swap where they have bonds outstanding. This company has debt. They've issued bonds. And so I would say, I want to insure $1 million of those bonds because I own them. If they go bankrupt, these bonds could become worthless. So you're going to insure those, and we'll set a price for how much it would cost for you to insure $1 million of bonds. Give me bond protection. Okay. Here's the fun part. I don't actually have to own those bonds, and neither you don't have to either. We can still write a derivative contract, a default swap, a credit default swap on top of what happens to that company, even though you don't own the debt. I don't own the debt and have no intention of ever owning the debt. That's not part of the landscape. No requirement there. Now, these derivatives are not always a great thing, but if you listen to the Federal Reserve, they think they are. Look at this lovely gentleman here. And he is saying here, asked about derivatives, and you know, Warren Buffett famously said they're weapons of financial weapons of mass destruction. And so this guy says, writing in here, quote, yes, derivatives are financial weapons of mass destruction. Firms and individual investors can keep a lot of money. Can lose a lot of money very quickly. Then, but you can also lose everything you invest in a single day in stocks and bonds. You can, but it's really hard to lose everything you've got in a single day on any particular stock or bond. It's not easy. Carrying on here, he says here, you can, and so including, you know, for that matter, any other kind of asset, including your house or your car or, painting, say, can decline rapidly in value too. Very helpfully telling us here. Yet the vast majority of derivatives traders and end users do not complain either. They don't complain because the contracts are useful in hedging, risks, or because they have consciously chosen to specialize using derivatives. Like, oh yes, you know what? You know, you could lose money lots of ways. Derivatives are just one. They don't complain. Yeah. You know why they don't complain? Because they wrote the laws to say that if they really lose a lot of money on these things, if these things go fall out of the band of normal distribution, fall to the edges of the tails, like a 3-4 sigma event, they have coverage for that. It's called the great taking. They have their fingers are tied to insurance on their insurance products, and we're the ultimate insurers of those backstop things. Now, you might think that's not likely to happen. You might think they would never do that. But as you'll see in a future episode, not only will they do that, but they've already done that. It's already been run up the flagpole of the court system. So we have case precedent, and I'm this kind of a guy. I think that if somebody says they're going to do something and they take the time to write it into law and then they run it through the court system, maybe that's what they intend to do. After all, why would you install a trigger if you never intended to pull it? And of course they have. So, but this is not a very defensible view. I would highly recommend that this gentleman go out and get some real world experience. Now, you know, what are derivatives? They are just, in some cases, they're bets on bets. One of the greatest movies out there, The Big Short. And here, this is Selena Gomez at a blackjack table playing a hand of blackjack, right? And the total value of that blackjack hand might be $10 million. That might be the value of a mortgage-backed security. It's $10 million. But the people behind her, which is represented by the crowd down here below, they're making bets on her bets. They're saying, hey, I'll bet you $200 million that her $10 million bet goes bust. You're on, right? So you could actually have a little tiny little underlying actual asset, say in this case, in this example, $10 million could have spawned $1 billion of related bets. So the leverage is extraordinary. You could have 10 or 20 times sometimes on average, the amount of bets on top of the thing itself. The thing itself has value X and the bets on top of thing itself are 10X that. A lot of fun because, you know, leverage is where you make a lot of money, more risk, more reward, more bonuses. And this is the best part. If you screw up, you just reach over and recapitalize yourself by taking the chips from the person next to you on the table. That's how the laws have been written. That's what this whole series is about. I'm just trying to get you to understand whether you think, oh, this is unpleasant to hear about, or this is doomerish. I'm just nothing. It's just reality. This is what's happened. These laws have been written in such a way that all of these parties over here are covered, and you're the one who's backstopping all of that. Now, if that doesn't feel right to you, it's because it's not. And you understand that to be in a culture, fairness matters. It is unfair that the Federal Reserve prints money out of thin air, hands it to their Wall Street buddies. They play with it like crazy, but whenever they get in trouble, they run over to the taxpayers and or the taxpayers' piles of wealth and say, we're going to need that to make us whole again, right? It's just, it's deeply unfair. So what do we know about derivatives, right? Well, we know that the top four banks in the U.S. alone have $200 trillion in derivatives. Four banks, $200 trillion. And so what are those? Well, remember these terms. We've already heard them, right? So we have forwards and futures, right? We've got, what do we have here? Let's see. Let me supersize this, make this just a little bit bigger. And we've got swaps, and we got options, and we have credit derivatives. And then the bottom bar all the way there on the bottom is adding all of those up. So forwards and futures and swaps and options and things like that. Wow, $200 trillion just for four banks. How much capital do those four banks have? Well, not that much, right? $221 trillion in just these four largest banks. You can see their names up there. JP Morgan Chase, Goldman, Citi, and BOA, Bank of America. And of course, there's more derivatives in other banks. And so we're well over, we're in very, very large number territory. But wait a minute. Wait a minute. So these gross fair values are actually a lot smaller. See that down there? They say, well, you know, yes, there's hundreds of trillions of these things, but the gross fair value of these things is just measured in a few billions. Meaning if you had to, a derivative contract is fundamentally a zero-sum bet. I'm going to bet you that this thing fails on a credit default swap, and you're going to bet me it doesn't fail. When we net those out, it gets to zero because one of us is wrong and one of us is right. All derivatives net out to zero, right? So ultimately, the question is, even if you have 220 trillion of these things, if you have enough hedging and you own the other side, and you own some of the underlying and you do all this and that, your actual current value at risk at that point in time can be a lot smaller. So the net is even smaller than that. Let's look at this. Credit derivatives, gross fair value, but then they have a gross fair positive value and a gross fair negative value. So then we average those out. And this is a snapshot at a current time, right? So it could be that your derivative portfolio is well hedged and it looks good, but then we have one of those pear-shaped, high sigma, you know, out of band, unnormal moments, and all of a sudden your derivatives work against you really powerfully and strongly. That's what we saw happen in the great financial crisis, right? Things got a little uncertain. So here's the great thing about derivatives. They are awesome until you need them. Then they fall apart. Doesn't sound good, does it? Well, it's not. It's really not a great system. So it turns out that all four banks, that's that green arrow down there, all four banks, if you combine their gross fair positive and gross fair negative values, you find out that it nets out that they're just in the hole about $756 million of net exposure. And of course, that could change. Tomorrow's market conditions might be different from today's, whatever. But that's how they add these things up. And again, it's all good as long as things are stable. This is why the Federal Reserve spends so much time watching the markets, pumping the markets, rescuing the markets, throwing cash in whenever necessary, because this whole thing is growing up and out. Editorially, after the great financial crisis, I agree. People looked into that. Things had gotten out of control. The regulators had fallen completely down on the job. The Federal Reserve wasn't doing its job. Wall Street ran amok. And we almost went towards that bright light in the sky, right? It was literally very close to a lights out event for our financial system. So they said that was terrible. They had closed door sessions. They wrote laws and they said, we shouldn't do that again. But instead of making the big banks smaller so they weren't too concentrated and making sure that the derivatives were not so large that out of band high sigma event could drag the whole system down, they actually encoded it so that those bets get paid off first and can capitalize off of the balance sheets of the other players, including brokers, clearinghouses, etc. They did that. And so now guess what? You'll be surprised. Totally surprised. We now have larger banks and more derivatives than we had at the height of the great financial crisis. Oh, but now they're more carefully regulated, Chris. Let's talk about this because there's a problem hiding in this. First, we're just talking volumes. According to the BIS, $7.5 trillion per day of derivatives trading is happening just in the OTC, which is over the counter. And it's very hard to get a good measure of these OTC amounts. That's why this is from April 2022. That's the most recent they could add this up. Like, we don't know. It's very hard to get these sort of data because OTC, often you just have to go to every single trading desk and ask what they're doing. So it's very difficult data to get. There's no particular button you can press and get this updated data because it's not tracked that way. But still, what's interesting is when you look at this, I've highlighted a couple things. Out of that $7.5 trillion a day, the official sector, that's central banks, the official sector is busy trading tens of billions of dollars of derivative contracts per day. Like, what exactly are they doing, those central banks, tens of billions of dollars per day of, you know, spot transactions and outright forwards, and they're doing foreign exchange, which is, you know, maybe the lion's share, about half of what they're doing, but they're trading in some pretty big stuff there. You could imagine a central bank doing forex and currency swaps, but they're doing outright forwards and things. It's weird. I'd like to get some data on that. But as well, look at that big yellow blob in that corner down there. So this is showing by country, the United Kingdom is actually, they're still the king of the place where you would trade OTC derivatives. London is by far the largest center of this. So if you thought old Blighty lost the Revolutionary War and sailed quietly off into the sunset, you know, empire waning in the distance, they've kept their hold on things here pretty tight from a financial standpoint. So just putting that out there. Now, Buffett, back in 2007, he said derivatives, a fool's game, right? So he said at his talks, I think it was at their annual meeting, he repeated his warning on the dangers of derivatives, saying, quote, that excessive borrowing by traders, investors, and corporations will eventually lead to significant dislocation in the financial market. So this is in 2007. Of course, he was very prescient about this. Obviously, by October 2008, he was right, you know? And he said here, quote, the introduction of derivatives has totally made any regulation of margin requirements a joke, referring to the government's rules on limiting the amount of borrowed money an investor can apply to each trade. He said, I believe we may not know where exactly the danger begins and at what point it becomes a super danger. We don't know when it will precisely end, but at some point, some very unpleasant things will happen in markets, end quote. Oh, he was absolutely right. Has he changed his mind? Well, this is from 2016, and he kept on with this, and there's more recent quotes, same thing, fresh warnings. This is Buffett, right? One of the most seasoned, awesome investors out there, very careful, does the due diligence, thinks these things through very carefully, and here, this is post Dodd-Frank, which went in 2010. This is post the lessons we were supposed to have learned from the great financial crisis, and we're 6 years past all of that, and what does he say? He says, emphasizing a warning he gave last summer when he described derivatives as weapons of mass destruction, Mr. Buffett said, a major event such as a cyber attack that shut down the financial markets would trigger enormous gaps in things you thought might be protected by collateral. Now, that's what we've been talking about. What is the collateral backing these derivatives? It's your stocks and bonds. It's all the collateral in the system. It's all the treasury notes. It's all the muni bonds. It's all the equity issues out there. You don't know it because you can't peer into it. But that's what this whole book, The Great Taking, is about in my exploration of it. And it's true, as far as I can unravel, that you can't answer this simple question. This should be easy. Who owns that? Right. Hey, here's my treasure. Here's my statement. And it shows that I have a Fidelity fund with treasuries in it. Who's the senior claimant? I own a share of this fund, but who really owns it? You should be able to answer that very simply. Here's the simple answer. It ought to be you. You are. But it's not that simple. They can't answer the question, and often they don't even know. And so if we get to one of these moments where there is a reset, a great reset, and they have to scramble, and you have to settle every derivative, and you have to settle every trade, and you have to do this in accordance with what are the qualified financial contracts, and who has senior claim, and all this other stuff, we're going to discover that there's a lot more claims than there is actual underlying assets. That's what Warren Buffett is talking about here when he says a cyber attack could shut down financial markets and it would trigger enormous gaps in things you thought might be protected by collateral. You thought you were doing a deal with somebody who had the collateral, but they didn't have the collateral. They were doing a deal with somebody they thought had the collateral, but they didn't have the collateral, and on and on. Like, who owns it is really important. And of course, possession is 10/10 of the law when it comes to these sorts of things. He said, I regard very large derivative positions as dangerous. We inherited a modest size position at Berkshire's reinsurance vehicle, General Ray, in a benign market. And we lost about $400 million just trying to unwind it with no pressure on us whatsoever. These are some of the best investors out there, and they lost $400 million just trying to get rid of this stupid derivative portfolio that they inherited. By the way, the accountants blessed that big derivative position as being worth a lot of money. They were only off by what? A few hundreds of millions, added Charlie Munger, then the vice president of Berkshire. May he rest in peace. So here's the problem. People act, Wall Street acts as if derivatives have somehow shot the risk of life, of financial products into outer space, never to be seen again. And that's not actually how that works. As I wrote, I think this was from last year sometime when I was writing, this is from my website, when I was writing for my subscribers, I said about derivatives and what might happen. I said, obviously, if you get a cascading series of domino defaults, it's going to be a problem. This is exactly why they froze the CDS paper during the 2008 meltdown. That's a credit default swap paper. Not only didn't the big banks want to pay off the scrappy little hedge funds, which we saw in The Big Short, but they were also worried about setting off a systemic disaster. The main complaint I have about this system of derivatives is that it does something really dumb. It acts as if risk has been somehow shot into outer space. That's not a thing. Risk doesn't go away because you spread it out. It merely gets spread out. Risk cannot be eliminated, only diluted, which means ultimately you have more risk-taking behavior, and therefore derivatives promote the accumulation of more risk, not less. So we have more risk today, not less, because we have more derivatives, not fewer, than we did back at the apex of the great financial crisis. Like twice as many. It's crazy. Carrying on, but everyone acts within their own portfolios and on their own balance sheets like the risk has entirely disappeared. Hey, I'm hedged. I'm hedged. I have these bonds, but I've bought a credit default swap. Good to go, right? That may be true for them, but it can't be true for everybody as a group. So where did the risk go? If everybody individually thinks their risk has been taken away, where'd it go? Because it's an accounting identity. You can't make risk go away. It's kind of like, well, you know, the chance of my house burning down is 1 in 1,000 per on any given year, say. But if we put 1,000 houses together, my risk has gone away entirely. Like, no, didn't go away. Just, you know, didn't happen. So I write here, I submit that risk is still there waiting for the right moment to suddenly reconcentrate, wipe out various participants, possibly in a cascade of defaults that will be exceptionally messy as we rediscover where the risk was hiding, who was holding the bag. In the end, though, it's always good to remember this. A derivative is just a legal contract. It's a document. It's a fat sheaf of papers that sits in a folder or on a hard drive. It's an agreement that falls under contract law. So any messy meltdown becomes a protracted, expensive, and mostly endless payday for lawyers. So I think Mark Twain said it best. We have to remember this now. I think when you look at a system that's grown up and, in fact, institutionalized what I would consider to be fraud, and the fact that I can't find a single person yet who can explain exactly how this whole system of derivatives and contracts and laws and the plumbing and piping of collateral and flows, I can't find any one person who knows all of that stuff anymore. So Mark Twain said, it ain't what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so. Agree with that. Insurance only works if everyone doesn't use it at once. Like if you were an insurance company and you insured this entire town of houses and they all burned down at once, you don't have it, you're broke, right? Insurance doesn't work unless it's operating within a stochastic model where very, very unusual things aren't happening, right? Excess deaths haven't gone to, like, you know, World War II levels on a percentage basis. Every house doesn't burn down all at once. Something like that. That's how it works. So if derivatives are insurance policies, they only work until you really need them, like this town needs their fire insurance in California. So Martinson's rule, risk cannot be eliminated by spreading it around. It still exists. Corollary, the more people spread this risk around, the more they will accumulate across the entire system. It's kind of like if we said, well, you know, I'm standing here in this tub of cow manure, and it's only this, you know, it's coming up close to my ankles. But good news, we're now going to spread it around on this tennis court. Oh, look, we can actually spread a lot. In fact, give me some more. We're going to spread this all around this tennis court. And then all of a sudden, something happens. Oops, tennis court goes away, and we have to put all of that risk that we've been putting out there in back into this tub. Well, now it might be up to my eyeballs, right? This is just how this works. So this is what a derivative position of one of those single large four banks might look like. It is literally just going to be box after box of legal documents or the equivalent on a hard drive. It is that's what it is. So you know what's going to happen when there is one of these big, giant, scary market clearing events, right? Well, when you positively need resolution right now, these derivatives claims are going to be tying up the courts for decades, decades and decades. It took till 2012, I think. And then finally 2018 to begin to unwind this stuff for the Lehman disaster. That's what derivatives are. Remember, they're not a thing. This is stuff, right? A derivative is just a contract. It's an agreement, set of agreements. And they could be very complicated agreements. So remember what we said before in earlier section, which was part three, which was under Title 12. This part actually exists, this exact language exists in, just in case you missed it, in case you're slow like me, right? This exists in Bankruptcy Code, which is Title 11, the Banking Code, which is Title 12, and also Uniform Commercial Code, Article 8, says the same thing, which says this, which is notwithstanding anything else written anywhere else, any provision, any state or federal law, not with, just throw all that stuff out the window. The corporation or anybody else acting as receiver may not avoid a transfer of money or other property in connection with any qualified financial contract with a covered financial company. So your company gets, your broker gets in trouble. Oh no, they're frozen. You can't get to your subordinated security entitlement claims. Sorry, you have to wait until we resolve this. Could take months, could take years, but we'll get you your stuff back eventually. But meanwhile, somebody who has a derivative position like Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, right? Any of those companies, any of the four big banks, any bank or any hedge fund or anybody has a qualified financial contract with that same brokerage. Well, says here, they get to reach in and take any money or other property, any other property. Yeah, take what you will, right? And remember, derivatives are these financial contracts, right? So if you take that together, look, you can't avoid the transfer of these things, which are derivatives. And derivatives are how big? Really big. You know, the explosive device has been installed. So global debt and liabilities are a couple, 2.5 quadrillion. So we've got 300 trillion of global debt. We've got 1.5 trillion of derivatives. We've got unfunded liabilities. Add it all up. It's a big number, right? That's 2.3 trillion plus some others. It's just really large. So with that, that is what I wanted to tell you about derivatives, right? So understand the difference between notional value and actual value at risk. Understand that that value at risk is just a snapshot in time, that if things get fat and pear-shaped and we get out there in those high standard deviation tail risk areas, that suddenly the calculus of derivatives may change a lot, that they are financial contracts, but they are contracts that have first dibs on the collateral in the system. You're going to be shocked to find out that the collateral in the system is not even as identified as you might think it is. And this brings up the big wide world of fun things called failure to delivers and whether or not all the actual issued shares are the sum total of shares that people think they own and things like that. Now, I'm going to take this into part two for my members. We are going to be talking about this for the love of money. We are facing a system now where the corruption has been running for so long that it's just become how things are and how things are done. Well, when that happens, you get to the end game part of this. Because remember, the last official act of any government is to loot the treasury. And we are now in a public-private partnership era where I think we're seeing the beginnings of what appear to be the machinery that would allow that large looting operation to happen. And of course, this goes by the Great Reset, which ultimately leads to us being able to say, now I think we understand what the trigger is and what might pull the trigger so that we can finally get to the statement of you'll own nothing and be happy. With that, thank you very much for listening. If you want to, please come by Peak Prosperity for this conversation because this is going to be awesome. All right. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sticking with all this. You're a rock star. We'll see you next time. And I've got more chapters of this coming out on a weekly basis. Bye-bye for now.